The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. So I hope that Gil feels better soon and that he finds some ease and not feeling well and that he has a speedy recovery. I spoke to him briefly this afternoon and he had a scratchy voice and he felt like it wasn't quite right for him to come speak tonight. So wish him well. And so tonight I thought that I would talk about how to support our practice. What are some ways that we can support practice? It's not always easy, right? Practicing, and there's certain things that we can do or that we can consider as a way to support our practice. So that's what I'd like to talk about. And the first thing that we can do is to define our practice. What is it that we have decided is going to be our practice? Is it just to come to IMC on Monday evenings? That's fine. Sit and listen to a Dharma talk. Maybe it's to practice loving kindness to others that we meet during our day, to try to kind of open our hearts, soften our heart to others we meet. Maybe it's to practice with ethics, with not taking that which isn't freely given, and even all those subtle ways, or to speak truthfully all the time. Maybe that's our practice. But there's a certain power in just kind of naming what is our practice, what is our intention of doing. And of course, a practice that we teach a lot here at IMC is mindfulness. Mindfulness meditation, as well as mindfulness in daily life. So if indeed that is our practice, mindfulness, then we can hold in our mind that our practice is to just notice, to be aware of what's happening, the sensations that we feel in our bodies or the events that are happening in our mind. So can we just know what is happening? Can we just, in a non-judgmental way, can we be with the experience, mindfulness? But of course, mindfulness requires more than just the experience. It requires also our relationship to the experience. I mentioned non-judgmental. So can we, in addition to noticing what's happening, can we notice how we are responding to what's happening? Are we pushing it away? Are we trying to hold it tighter? Or maybe we're kind of, there's a little bit of fogginess, or it's not quite clear what's happening, or maybe a quality of dreaminess to it. So we can look at the qualities of our mind, the attitudes in our mind, our mental states. Are they kind of colored with a certain amount of greed for more, especially if we're having pleasant experiences, whether they're nice memories or whether we have a nice warmth in our heart? Either of those, we can notice our relationship to them. We can notice, are we pushing away? Do we have aversion, whether it's that pain in their knee that happens when we sit? Or whether we notice that we're kind of having this compulsive, ruminative, repetitive thoughts that are going over and over and over that we can't seem to let go of. Are we kind of pushing that away and wishing that weren't there? Or again, sometimes we're not even quite sure what's happening, that we don't have any strong, compelling feelings in our bodies or in our minds, but maybe there's a certain kind of lostness or fogginess. So our mindfulness practice can be noticing both what's happening as well as the relationship to what's happening. And then in addition, kind of one of the classic teachings in the Buddhist suttas and the scriptures in the Buddhist literature So also an emphasis on noticing what are the conditions that caused what we're experiencing. That's either whether it's our reaction to what we're experiencing or the actual experience itself. Not that we have to do an investigative or an archaeological dig to find exactly things why things are, but it just naturally happens when you start to notice what's happening. You start to notice, oh, it kind of makes sense this is happening because something else was happening right before it. I can give an example that I used to come on IMC a lot on Sunday mornings, and on Sundays, I would just be doing whatever it is I did on Sunday mornings. And then I look at the clock, oh my gosh, I was going to go to IMC, I better get going, okay, where's my coat, my shoes, and run around and get my things, and jump into my car, oh my gosh, I'm going to be late, I don't want to be late. And I drive kind of fast. And then I have one of my secret pleasures was to listen to the radio really loud in the car. I just like to sing along while I'm driving, so I'd be driving fast, singing on my way to IMC, and then I'd wonder why I rushed in here, took off my shoes, sat down, and I'd wonder, why can't I settle down? And why do I have this song that's going in my mind over and over again? Honestly, it took me a while to kind of make this connection, right? Because I had kind of thought that, you know, what happens when you sit was when you sit, and how you get there, well, that's not practice. It doesn't really affect you, right? Practice is just what you're formally doing when you sit on the cushion. So this is something that are in the suttas that are talked about a lot, too, is just to notice the conditions for what's arising, like whether it's something that's a mind that can settle down, whether it's some uncomfortableness in our bodies, are we not taking care of ourselves, are there some way that we can sit that is more comfortable, or whether it's our just disliking whatever is happening, is that because we've been fueling this kind of dislike by reading blogs on the internet or that are filled with a certain type of venom or something like this, that then we find ourselves filled with that venom as well. So as a sort of practice, as a support for practice, we can define our practice. And if it's mindfulness, we can look at what's happening, our relationship to what's happening, as well as just notice that we notice the conditions that support what's happening. We don't have to go looking for them actively. We'll just notice them, but notice that we notice the conditions. That's one thing we can do to support our practice. Another thing that we can do to support our practice is to examine our underlying beliefs, some of our values. So in addition to mindfulness, we can look at our mindset. That is, you know, what is our views, our world views? And I offer some here that have been really helpful for me, that I had some views that I didn't even know I had until they became so, glaringly obvious after lots of practice and struggle. And one here is this idea of, what do you think practice should look like? Do you have this idea that practice, this is one that I had, is only when I'm really sitting in a meditation posture with my eyes closed, erect spine, relaxed, mindfulness on the breath, and everything else, I don't know what that was, but practice was just only this on the cushion. Well, that maybe worked okay until there came a time when, I don't know why, but I just could not bring myself to sit on the cushion. I just couldn't do it. I don't know why exactly. I just was having a lot of difficulty in just bringing myself to a regular meditation practice. But I still felt like I was a practitioner, and I still felt like this was very meaningful for me. And so I had to kind of broaden my idea, okay, what is practice? And the truth is, as I was talking with Jim briefly just a few moments before the sit began, and he was telling me about a book that he's reading by Jon Kabat-Zinn, which really resonated. And I guess, according to Jim, Jon Kabat-Zinn is saying that we're always practicing something. If we're not practicing mindfulness, then we're practicing mindlessness. Right? We're always, you know, this is the way our brains work, that we have certain habits that we're fueling either mindfulness or maybe we're fueling the habits to be distracted or to think that things are important or to be bored or I don't know what it is exactly, but always practicing something. So this means that bringing attention to our breath while we're standing in line at the grocery store, this is practice. Bringing attention to the ground underneath our feet while we're having a difficult conversation, this is practice. Setting the intention to notice, like how are we interacting with others? Are we interacting with others with a spirit of generosity and giving them the benefit of the doubt and kindness? That's practice. Of course, officially sitting in a meditation posture and meditating is practice too. So I just offer this is just to evaluate, examine, what are your ideas about what does practice have to look like? And what is practice? Just ask yourself this as a way to kind of support you in your practice. Do you have ideas of what is and what isn't? And maybe one way to examine this was helpful for me was to look at all the ways I talk myself out of practicing. Like, oh, it doesn't really count if it's just for 5 minutes. Oh, it doesn't really count, as I said, if I'm not in a meditation posture. Or just that could be a kind of a doorway in to see how some of the thoughts you have about practice. A second belief that you can look at or examine as a way to support your practice are, what are your ideas about comfort? You know, again, right, I had this idea that comfort is of paramount importance. If any of you have ever been with me on a meditation retreat, you know that I sometimes was that person that had all the scarves and blankets and pillows and water bottle, and you know, I had everything, right? You had to like optimize, you know, comfort just in case the temperature wasn't quite right, or just in case I had that little pain in my knee, or just in case. But, you know, it turns out that feeling uncomfortable doesn't mean that we're failing. It doesn't mean that it's not a normal experience. It doesn't mean that something is absolutely wrong. Sometimes it does. Sometimes being uncomfortable is a sign that things aren't right and we have to pay attention to it. But not always. And there's something very powerful about learning to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. In fact, that can be transformative. If we can be a little bit more comfortable and that in our meditation posture, can we hold the posture even though it's not the most comfortable any longer? There's like, we're only one person, we only have one mind. So even like practicing with uncomfortableness with sitting carries over into other areas of our life. I gave the example earlier of having difficult conversations. It's easier to have difficult conversations that are filled with honesty, but are saying something uncomfortable, if we have lots of experience that being uncomfortable is okay, that being uncomfortable is not something that we absolutely have to avoid, but instead can be looked at with wisdom. Is this uncomfortableness something I should avoid, or is this something that's going to support me with my practice? So that's a second belief that we can look at, is our ideas, our mindset towards comfort. A third one, a mindset that we can examine, is what are our ideas about self-criticism? Do we believe that we need to have a voice in our head that is saying things to us to motivate ourselves? I know I say things to myself I would never say to anybody else. I say, you know, some of the things are kind of awful. But I think underneath I had this belief that if I didn't say these types of things to myself, if I wasn't hard on myself, then somehow I would just be lounging around, eating bonbons, watching reruns on TV, I don't know, you know, something. But in fact, there's a lot of research that's just happening in these past few years. It's kind of exciting research where they've been examining this idea of self-criticism versus self-compassion. That is, when we find that we're doing something wrong, quote-unquote, or we've made a mistake, we all make mistakes, whether we beat ourselves up for it or whether we're able to be present for that uncomfortable experience makes a difference. And researchers, psychologists, are doing studies now that are showing that those people who practice self-compassion as opposed to self-criticism actually are more productive and actually have more life satisfaction, actually have more ease, partly because they're not spending that energy beating themselves up, and partly because if they're part of having self-compassion is just meeting the truth of what's happening. It's part of having mindfulness of, yes, this is suffering. I made a mistake. This is uncomfortable. And then part of self-compassion can include a little bit of soothing. For me, I find myself saying, it's okay. Not because I want to condone everything and not because it's everything's perfect, but just to help kind of bring in the reins of how bad it really is. Instead of, you know, getting into the snowball effect of all the terrible things about it. So we can examine our ideas about self-criticism. Do we believe that this is the way to support ourselves or to support our practice or to be a better person? Or can we believe that self-compassion, taking care of ourselves, which includes discipline, right? Self-compassion isn't the same as indulgence. It's not the same as pity. It's not the same as letting ourselves off the hook and to do anything that we want. Self-compassion is about meeting the suffering that's happening and taking care of ourselves so that we can meet it completely, mindfully. And with the wish that we don't do it again in the future so that we don't have to have that suffering again. So it's about wishing to ease the suffering in our lives as opposed to increasing the suffering with just further self-criticism. So that's a third view that we can look at, some underlying belief to help support our practice, is our view about self-criticism. Here's a fourth one. What are our beliefs? What is our mindset? What do we think about stress? I know we often hear, you know, that stress is, you know, causes all kinds of health issues and psychological issues, and certainly this is true, it does. But also there's been a lot of research in just these past few years about it's not all bad. Not stress isn't completely bad. But one thing that contributes to the deleterious effects is our attitude about stress. If we believe that stress should be avoided at all costs, but then stress happens, you know, there's some that adds more stress to it. If we are isolating ourselves when we feel stressed, of course, that makes it worse. So somebody just recently gave me a book that was just published, I think just a few weeks ago, called The Upside of Stress. I haven't read this entire book. I've just flipped through it as I'm wont to do with these types of books. But even the title, The Upside of Stress, it's written by Kelly McGonigal, who's taught here before, I believe. Just that title kind of makes you think like, oh, what is this? This is a new idea, the upside of stress. There's something good about it, as opposed to this is something that is all bad and we should orchestrate our lives in order to avoid it at all costs. Some of the things that Kelly talks about in her book is that the stress, of course, has a physiological response, including like increased heart rate or adrenaline. She said that one of the things that we can do is we can harness that energy of stress and use it to be productive, to use it towards things that are consistent with our values. I can tell you, I was a little bit stressed this afternoon when Gail said, Diana, can you give this talk? And I used that energy to kind of like sit down and start writing some notes, like, okay, what am I going to talk about, right? So we can harness the energy and use it as opposed to just have it have these physiological response of adrenaline that just keeps on running and running. We can use it to support us to do things that are consistent with our values or to make decisions that are consistent with our intentions and values. Another thing that Kelly talks about is stress is to recognize part of the reason, not always, part of the reason why we feel stressed is because our values are being threatened. What's important to us is being threatened, or we feel like it'll be compromised. So when we feel stressed, we can use it as a reminder to look at what are our values? What is most important? If our values are to have autonomy and have free to use our time as we want and plenty of opportunity for creativity and to express ourselves as a way that we would like, then maybe it won't be stressful to lose our jobs if what we want is free time and money isn't our highest concerns. But maybe it is stressful with the idea of losing our jobs. And so then we can look at, well, what is it I want? What is it about having a job that is important? We want to care for others in our families. We want to support them. Maybe we want to share some skills, expertise that we have with the world, put them to good use in a way that benefits others and benefits ourselves. Maybe it's we want to work. Maybe our job is doing something in the world that we believe in. So the stress related to the fear of losing our job, we can tie it into what is our values, what matters to us the most. So I'm not going to say that all stress is good and that it's always easy to do these, to look at it a little bit differently. But I am saying that we can examine what are the views we have about stress. Do we think that it's always bad? And do we think that it must always be avoided? Or instead, can we see like, oh yes, of course it's a little bit stressful to do something new or to extend our boundaries of what we think we're capable of. That's always a little bit stressful, but that's always also a part of kind of living a rich life too, is to kind of push the boundaries a little bit. So that's the fourth belief that we can examine about to help us support our practice. The first one was, what are our views about practice? What are our views about comfort? What are our views about stress? And what are our views about self-criticism? So a third thing that we can do to support our practice, in addition to identifying our practice and looking at our views, is, of course, the Buddhist teachings are filled with things to support our practice. In fact, you could say maybe that even all the teachings are to support our practice. That's why they're there, and they're filled with all kinds of different things, including, I'll just name a few here, the precepts. The bliss of blamelessness is very supportive to practice. That is, to not kill living beings, not take that which is not freely given, to be very careful with our sexual energy, to not tell what is not true, not say what is not true, and to not intoxicate our minds. These are some of the things that really support our practice to help us have some ease. Some other Buddhist teachings that support our practice is the teaching of simplicity. Right? I think that we won't find anywhere in the teachings that having more things helps us with our practice, but instead there's a movement towards simplicity, renunciation. I keep on using this word simplicity, but kind of, you know, this idea that maybe less can be more. It doesn't have to be more is more. That's what kind of the key Buddhist teaching as well. Something else that can support our practice is this idea of not clinging, not holding on really tightly to things, including those views that I talked about. If we examine our views, but not cling to them. The Buddhist teachings aren't about not having views. They're about not clinging to views. Of course, clinging to views causes divisiveness, a real sense of my views are right and therefore your views are wrong. As well as it just causes a lot of suffering for both ourselves and others. Anything that we hold on to causes suffering. I think that's, of course, is one of the key Buddhist teachings. Another one is about equanimity. It's kind of a Buddhist teaching, is this idea of, can we hold things with an openness, with a certain amount of ease, with not clinging, as well as can we see the big picture at the same time? Can we have kind of like a bird's eye view of what's happening so that we can see the different perspectives or the different elements that may be involved in whatever's happening and whatever our response is to whatever's happening? Can we just hold it either with a really big way so that, yes, this is happening, but maybe also this is happening? Or can we hold it like with a bird's eye view and see like, oh yes, there's many different ways to look at it? It's another way to kind of think about equanimity. As well as equanimity is, of course, tied in with not clinging, you know, not holding into, I think it's this way and I know it's this way, or, but instead with kind of an open-handed way. So consider the Buddhist teachings. Also, there we can use the stories, some of the stories in the Buddhist teachings, to inspire us, or maybe even to challenge us a little bit. Both of those are valid ways to kind of be engaged with our practice, whether we feel inspired perhaps by the life story of the Buddha. Or maybe there's some teaching that we don't quite understand and we don't feel comfortable with or we're not quite sure about. That also can support our practice as a way to just engage in. And then the fourth way that we can use to support our practice, in addition to defining our practice, examining our underlying beliefs, and using the Buddhist teachings to support it, the fourth way is kind of one of the maybe fundamental Buddhist teachings, and that is the teaching of the middle way. Of course, in the story of the Buddha, the middle way often refers to he had a life filled with sensual pleasures. He had lots of riches and courtesans and food and probably everything anybody can imagine. And he left that behind and was doing some practices of self-mortification, not eating, even tried not breathing. And the suttas actually are filled of all kinds of really extreme ascetic practices. And then, of course, the story is, right, he found the middle way, not either sensual pleasures, not self-mortification nor extreme asceticism, but a way in which that he could be in the world without clinging to pleasures, but still having pleasures. So in the same way, with our practice, can there be a middle way? Can we not run away from the difficulties? Can we avoid the extremes of running away? Can we avoid the extreme of repressing what's happening? Instead, can we just be mindful of what's happening as best we can? Can we avoid the extreme of indulgence as best we can? Also, can we avoid the extreme of being completely passive? Oh, it's okay, as long as I just every now and then bring my attention to my breath, or as long as I don't know exactly what complete passiveness would mean, but can we avoid that extreme as well as the opposite one of over-striving, of doing a lot of convinced that if we just apply ourselves and work harder and harder and harder, then certainly we'll get more and more concentrated the more that we work. Right? Somehow that doesn't quite work that way, but it's easy to imagine that it would, because other areas of our life we have this idea that we need to work more. So can we have a middle way in between passivity and really over-striving? And then I would like to extend this idea of middle way even a little bit further and to include, can we hold opposites in our mind at the same time? For example, can we hold that within suffering there can be strength? Within anxiety there can be capability? Within threat, there can be hope. Within challenge, there can be opportunity. So as this is part of our mindfulness, as we're experiencing what's happening and we're looking at our relationship to what's happening, can we hold that maybe there's more than one thing that's happening, or maybe it's not just one thing? Maybe it's both. We feel strong as well as we're suffering. Maybe both happen at the same time. Or maybe they're tangled up together in a way that we don't have to just tease them apart. It doesn't have to necessarily be one or the other. Maybe that wasn't the best example, strength and struggle. But there's often, can we just hold more than one idea, opposites together in our mind? I think many of us have this, have heard this saying. I've heard Gil say it quite a number of times. And the reason why he says it a number of times, I believe, is because it's powerful. Is Suzuki Roshi, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, saying, I don't know the exact quote, but something like, you are perfect. And you could use a little work. Right, so kind of we hold both of these in our mind as part of the middle way. As well as the Buddhist teachings are, we can do things to support ourselves and to support others. We don't have to choose one way or the other. We can do both. As well as in our lives, we can make choices that support our short-term goals as well as our long-term aspirations. We can choose, we can have both. We can choose things that honor both of those. So in that way, that was my fourth way to kind of support our practice, is to embrace the middle way, which is including avoiding extremes and holding opposites in our minds. So maybe I'll just go through this one last time about supporting practice. This is to define our practice, examine our underlying beliefs, consider the supports that Buddhist teachings offer for our practice, and to embrace the middle way. So we have just we have a few minutes here if some people would like to ask questions or comments or protests about what I said. Yes, can we use the microphone?
No, I'd just like to mention something related to cognitive neuroscience. And I don't know if you know the book When Zebras, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. Anybody know it? Dr. Robert Sapolsky, who's one of the world experts in neurobiology, who's a professor at Stanford and has done a tremendous amount of research, wrote the book. And the major point is that to be in a long-term state of stress is very damaging to the brain. It produces too much cortisol to the brain, which can then cause a breakdown in the neurons, and it's pretty serious. It can lead to cognitive impairment later on. So what he's talking about is that the middle way, so to speak, that there's going to be stress all over the place. How you manage it is significant. But knowing that to stay in that stress state, it's like I was in a job as a social worker in one situation where I was stressed 24 hours a day. I mean, I thought about it after I suffered with it 10 hours a day, working with very difficult cases. And the point is, I had to leave because I couldn't manage to de-stress from it while I was there. And so he's done very significant studies, first with baboons and then measuring fMRIs on humans. So coming from neuroscience, there's a lot that we can benefit from. Another a group of neuroscientists did a study on various behaviors, or some of what you were describing, that's really beneficial to the brain. And I'll just do five of them and then I'll stop. Challenge, not constant challenge, but some challenge, some fun. And they've looked at this through, again, functional MRI. Novelty. Putting some novelty into your life, and it could be something as simple as going to a store you've never been in, but doing stuff that's novel, doing some activities that are multisensory, where you're using all your senses, or at least three or four of them at the same time, and then meditation. We know there are many, many, many activities, and it's all been written about now, and it covers all that you said. But so I'm just letting people know that it's really interesting to look at the Sharp Brain's website. Has all the latest findings in the world of cognitive neuroscience, the world of research on how to benefit the mind, body, spirit.
Great, thank you. Yes, right, this of course is an area of a lot of interest and research. I'm happy to hear that.
Thank you, Diana. When you talk about stress, do you distinguish that from dukkha?
Oh, I think maybe that's a question that you all get to answer for yourselves, don't you? Right, so is there something that we can learn from things that are uncomfortable? Is there something that we can learn from things that are stressful, but is there something we can learn from dukkha? Thank you, that's actually a good question. Yeah, so dukkha is the Buddhist word that is very often translated as suffering. But one translator, Chinnisaro Bhikkhu, he translates it as stress. It's also Lee Brazenton translated it as bummer. I kind of like that. And so one of the Buddhist teachings is that stress is a part of life, suffering is a part of life, dukkha is a part of life. Yes. Okay, so it's 9 o'clock, and I'd like to dedicate the merit for Gil for his speedy recovery. And I'd like to thank you all for your attention. If you'd like to ask some questions, you're welcome to come up here. Thank you.